Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Reports Technology Report. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Joining us today is Brandon Tsang. He is the president and co-founder of Shield AI. He's a former SEAL and surface warfare officer who founded the company in 2015 in partnership with his brother, a close friend, after his unit took casualties in Afghanistan because of a lack of adequate reconnaissance on a hostile building. The company is now valued at $3 billion and has some very exciting technology that they're working for the department. Brandon, welcome to the program, and it's great to have you on.
Thank you so much for having me, Vago. Excited to chat with you today.
An absolute pleasure. And a quick word from our sponsors before we get started. The Defense and Aerospace Report and its family of publications is brought to you by HII, General Atomics Aeronautical Systems, GE Aerospace, Bell, Leonardo DRS, and American Rheinmetall. Brandon, you guys were born in 2015 at a time when the Pentagon was just getting underway with its big innovation drive. This is now a crowded field. So the good news is that Shield is an increasingly known name, mentioned, you know, with the likes of Anduril and Palantir and other companies as part of that innovative group of companies. The flip side of that, and you guys also started similarly, right? That you guys started with software or AI and are expanding into hardware. That's a little bit like Anduril. And through acquisitions like Martin, that gave you guys VBAT, which is an interesting aircraft that Brazil has ordered. What's different about Shield and what differentiates it in an increasingly crowded market, where you've got a lot of companies that do very similar things, right? Matching software, matching AI, and matching it with hardware.
Yeah, I think that's actually a misperception that a lot of companies do a lot of similar things. And I'll cover down on it, right? You see a lot of noise around how people talk about AI, AI this, AI that, sprinkle AI on this. But, you know, just to cover, to immediately address, you know, what differentiates Shield AI, I point to three things, and that's our primarily around our products. First and foremost, we are the only company in the world with an aircraft that can operate without GPS, without communications, without a remote pilot, and successfully execute the mission. We first launched our AI pilot on our quadcopter Nova back in 2018. It's been deployed to SOCOM to near every battlefield since 2018. I'm proud to say that it's been used on the, you know, missions of highest importance. These are missions that, you know, some of our tier one soft operators go on. And then I'm also very proud to say that this capability was used by Israeli National Mission Forces to rescue hostages on October 7th and October 8th, have direct feedback from our end users about how the Nova quadcopter with our Hivemind AI pilot saved lives. So I'm very proud of that product, but it's not a core focus of the business today. It was a stepping stone for us to deploy AI pilots on more strategic aircraft. And so the second thing I'll point out that differentiates Shield AI is that we have more flight hours than anybody in the world flying jet aircraft completely autonomously in real, you know, simulated mission combat scenarios. Right. We won the DARPA Alpha dogfight in 2020. 2 years later, we were the first ever to fly the F-16 autonomously. That was December 22. We were the only company down-selected, the only AI provider down-selected for the final phase of the DARPA ACE program. Last year, we continued to fly F-16 completely autonomously, did incredible things. I would say so incredible that the U.S. Air Force has nominated us for the Collier Trophy, nominated the team for the Collier Trophy, right, which is awarded to, you know, the greatest achievement in aviation and astronautics. And we're a finalist there. We should find out at the end of the month. And then the third thing that I would point to is, our VBAT, MQ-35 VBAT product. It's done 17 deployments with the Navy and the Marine Corps, is the only military designated Group 3 vertical takeoff and land aircraft, making real mission impact every single day. Interdicted over $1 billion of drugs in the Caribbean Sea, have found sea mines in the Black Sea, helping in CENTCOM, UCOM, SOUTHCOM, PAYCOM, you name it. We're operating every single day, 24 hours, and we just launched a swarming product, our AI pilot on that product just last year. And so those are the three things that I would claim differentiate Shield AI publicly, and then there's a lot of other stuff going on inside the business that is what I would claim the secret sauce.
First of all, that's an incredibly impressive list, and we wish you the best of luck in the Collier competition, which is a tremendous honor to be nominated. And certainly, I mean, it's an honor to be nominated, much less to win it. So fair winds following seas on that. So let me just ask you a quick question, right? I mean, given what it is that you guys do, which is unique to operate in GPS denied environments, there's a lot of debate, or there's some debate, right? Or there's some skepticism, Brandon, that the United States might be taking a very big risk to put its eggs in an autonomous basket to operate on the other side of the Western Pacific, for example, and use, and bet big on this autonomous technology to operate an MCON, emission controlled alpha, right? I mean, the most denied airspace where space navigation and a lot of other comms will be interrupted. Are you confident that the capabilities you're developing with the U.S. military are going to be able to operate in even the most demanding environments and still be able to execute complex missions?
Yes, 100%. It's rooted in two things. One, first principles, and could talk through the engineering, the science that goes into building autonomous systems. But two, we've also just done it, right? We've done it on our quadcopter. The hardest environments imaginable are inside, indoor, high threat environments, dust, darkness, noise, tunnel systems, no GPS, no communications, with the most demanding special operations forces on the planet, and we've successfully executed. Actually, the work that we're doing on F-16, on CCAs, on VBAT is actually from a technical discipline. Like, it is much simpler and much, more straightforward to achieve autonomy in denied environments than it is for something like a quadcopter, which is extremely swap constrained and has its own challenges.
Let me take you to the overall environment. SHIELD got its first contract from what was then DIUX, the Defense Innovation Unit Experimental, that became DIU, and you guys fielded capability pretty quickly after that in 2018, operational, or 2017 or 2018. Since then, you guys have managed to secure more investment, to secure more contracts, as you said, more broadly across the U.S. military, as well as with our international allies and partners, Israel being one of them, and as you said, an extremely demanding customer, right? I mean, they don't go outside their borders to buy something unless it's really good. And you guys managed to do that. There was some skepticism even early on when DIU was started, whether it would be able to succeed in two parts, right? Whether it would be able to foster companies like yours to grow them to any significant scale to make it through the Valley of Death. And we'll get to that in a moment. And the second piece was whether or not the whole system would be able to accelerate to be able to deliver those capabilities at the speed of relevance. As someone who got in this game early and has been part of this process, what's the Pentagon getting right in its innovation approach? Where is it moving faster and where there's room for improvement?
I think where the Pentagon is getting it right is in their mindset, right? There's been a culture shift since 2015 that is more accepting and recognizes the shortcomings of our existing force structure and also recognizes the solution, to your point, right? Recognizing that autonomy is the critical enabler that only not only unlocks the warfighting concept of mass, but also unlocks the ability to operate in electronic warfare environments. That comes from a mindset shift where it's like, you know what? What we have today is not going to work for the fight for tomorrow. And I give great credit. This started under Ash Carter, then Secretary Mattis carried the torch under the Trump administration, and even under the Biden administration, this torch has been carried, which is a broad recognition that the fighting force that we use, that I used from 2001 to 2020, is not the force that you want to deter and, if necessary, win a conflict against a peer adversary like a China, a Russia, an Iran.
What do you think are some of the things that they can do, right? I mean, you guys pride yourselves on being able to deliver a kind of a common theme among all of the innovative companies, whether it's AeroVironment, whether it's Anduril, whether it's Palantir, you name it, the focus is actually being able to deliver at scale and deliver at what the customer wants, right? Ultimately, how are you finding all of the supply chain parts of this, right? I mean, if the customer was going to come to you and say, hey, we need 10,000 VBATs, what's your approach to actually being able to deliver those 10,000 VBATs?
Yeah, it's how any business would deliver a product at scale, right? And you know, I think there's always a lot of focus on the scaling challenges, and people say, oh, it's hard, or we can't do this in the timelines. I'd say let industry show you what they can do. Let industry show us what we can do. There are numerous successes in the Defense Department where we have rapidly scaled manufacturing and production in recent times. There are a lot of success stories, you know, if people do a little bit of research in the Defense Department around how we have gone from zero to thousands of loitering munitions or drones just in the past 3 years. So it's not I think people like to overemphasize the supply chain challenges. Yes, it's hard to go from, you know, zero to 10,000, but it's, you know, let industry face that problem. That is what we do best. We tackle really, really, really hard challenges and we deliver. And we're not going to, you know, at least, you know, at Shield AI, you set up a delivery schedule and you have honest conversations and let the customer know the risks, the challenges in doing so. But it's because it's a team effort, but it doesn't mean that challenge can't be accepted. And what is Shield AI going to say, hey, we can go from up to 10,000 VBATs in a month? No, that would be, you know, that would not be possible. But you know, if DoD were to send the order and we'd work with our supply chain, we would then go back and say, here's the delivery schedule, DoD, to get what you want. Here's the, you know, the fastest one we can do. Here's the most probable course we can do. And here's a worst case scenario. But that's the conversation that happens, you know, behind closed doors around how industry can meet the supply chain challenges with the Defense Department.
One of the points, and we heard that on yesterday's show with the Army Undersecretary Gabe Camarillo, but we've heard the same thing from Dr. LaPlante. We've heard the same thing from Secretary Kendall, that actually budgetary uncertainty and living under continuing resolutions has a trickle-down effect impact on industry. It makes it very hard to start new contracts. It makes it very hard to change anything. From your standpoint as a new company in the field trying to deliver for the customer, how is that budgetary and funding uncertainty hitting you and shaping your decision-making?
Yeah, it definitely impacts your decision-making, your planning processes, right? Your working capital requirements. But at the same time, right? It's look, I can either say I want the market to change, or I can run the business as the market currently exists. And so that means, right, you know, and this is what every single prime contractor in the world does, because we understand the budgetary volatility associated working with defense, we diversify our customer base. And this is largely, again, via our international allies and partners, but also around, you know, commercial aspects of what we're doing too, whether that's oil and gas or whether, you know, that's, you know, any other commercial product that, you know, we would introduce to the field. But that's how you deal with it. And so it's a challenge. The budgetary volatility, continuing resolutions are not a fun thing to deal with, but you can't, you know, it's, look, that's the reality. And so you can either, you know, it's like you just have to deal with that. And you do that by figuring out other customer revenue streams.
Let me take you to a point that Palantir Shyam Sankar, has made repeatedly, right? I mean, he said that just as the Pentagon had a last supper, it should have a first breakfast and needs to relearn how to deal with founder-led companies that are motivated by very, very different principles than the big primes, right? I mean, if you're a big company and the street has a certain profit expectation, or you've gotten them used to share buybacks, which have started becoming increasingly an issue for some in the Pentagon. We heard from the Navy Secretary about that, the chiding that he did at West of the industry. From your standpoint, does the Pentagon understand how to deal with founder-led companies? And what are the things that it needs to do to encourage you guys? I'm going to get to the Valley of Death or the Mountain of Death in a minute. But do they understand what your guys' motivations are and your willingness to actually accept far lower profit margin, for example, than one of the bigs, in order to be able to grow, to expand, and to create that foothold? Because you and your brother and a small team founded this company. And so it's kind of right. Your reward, what's driving you is a little bit different than what might be driving
I think it's not necessarily founder led companies and understanding the difference there. It's really just they look at business as a monolith. And I've had numerous conversations, and you really have to understand the business that you're working with and what they're going to deliver and what motivates them, right? There's a big difference between a multi-billion dollar venture-backed company like Shield AI and what our goals are versus a $10 million venture-backed company or a $10 million mom-and-pop shop, right? That's an SBIR mill. Or there's a big difference between that and a private equity shop that's raised $70 million to roll up a couple businesses and then sell it in 5 years. And there's a big difference between that and, you know, you have the publicly traded prime. And so that is something I think that the DoD struggles with, right? They have one acquisition system that was shaped, you know, during that Last Supper, which is it's shaped for one type of company, which is the, you know, and one type of acquisition, which is right, these large, exquisite, costly assets that are made by the traditional primes. And I think the DoD, right, they can do a better job training and educating their acquisition force to really understand where a company is, what they're offering, what stage, what motivates them. It's not, hey, is this founder led or, you know, not founder led or a publicly traded company. There's, you know, about 50 different variables that should go under their, you know, their little table in terms of understanding who they're working with and what they're going to get out of that relationship.
Is it changing at all as far as you're concerned? And what specifically would you change? Right. I mean, what advice would you give, for example, build a plant, which I'm sure you've done privately or to a Heidi Shu or service secretaries or service acquisition executives to try to improve the system?
And so this is my recommendation would not necessarily about be a, there's a long list. What I said previously about training to understand the different types of business would not be the top recommendation. If I had to give one recommendation, and I repeatedly give it to the Defense Department, it is around acquisition. It's around requirements reform. And so this comes from 9 years operating in the market. And really, I'm an engineer. I think about first principles. And so root cause is something I obsess over. And so after many layers of why, I decided that, holy smokes, it's fundamentally driven by the requirements process. And this, it's not a contracting problem. It's not an innovation problem, right? And even it's not necessarily, people will point to the budget and say it's a budgetary problem. There are certainly, that would be number two, like how we actually plan. But I would claim the budget is driven by the requirements. I wouldn't claim, that's a fact, that our budget is driven by requirements. Our contracts are driven by the budget. They're also driven by the requirements. And it's, you know, there's the old saying, if Henry Ford had asked customers what they want, they would say faster horses. Asking the customer to write what they want is the opposite of innovation. It's slow moving. I would use the analogy when I was, you know, a Navy SEAL, we could all quickly recognize what the problem was, right? There is someone on the top of the hill. But if I asked what the solution is, I'd get, you know, 100 different solutions. And that's what I would claim happens. Like, people can't stack hands on the requirements today. And it's just the most bureaucratic, long drawn out process to go to, you know, it has to go up to 4-star generals in the JROC to actually say, yes, this is a validated requirement. Right. And that's bonkers in terms of how you think about the speed that DoD needs to move when they're all about, you know, pushing down authority down to the lowest levels. But you have people saying, well, we have to, because this is so important, we have to slap hands on the requirements. And even that is a council. And so it's like, it's much easier for everybody to stack hands on the problem. And so I would shift from a requirements-based acquisition system to a problem-based acquisition system. And then I would change things to the budget that requires Congress. And to be clear, this is really hard to do. And I empathize with having to transform the bureaucracy. That's not an easy thing. It's easy for me to say, really hard to execute.
But there is a lot of wisdom to that, right? I mean, ultimately, what you're saying is listening more closely to the problems the operator has and how to figure out how to solve that problem. Although they would argue, right? I mean, the counter argument to that is the current requirement system tries to frame that and create some form of framework, right? What are the things that I need to standardize? Because it's not just Brandon, right? It's not just the Shield AI gadget. The Shield AI gadget's got to work with everything else, right? Whereas what you're sort of articulating is a little bit purer, a little bit simpler. Is part of this also getting away, Brandon, from the notion that you buy something for the next five, you know what I mean? That you're buying five decades? Is that part of the problem?
That's part of the challenge, right? Is there are these, because it takes so long, these program offices, right? The Joint Strike Fighter program is a 40, 50 year program. Like that's what everybody's back hands on in terms of the budget. I think it's bonkers to say that we know what the Air Force's needs are going to be 40, 50 years from now. And that Joint Strike Fighter is going to, you know, answer the mail on that. And so we absolutely must get into a more rapid acquisition cycle. Now, I understand if a company is going to make the massive CapEx investments, there has to be some sort of visibility into a long duration program. Like if you're going to build an aircraft carrier, if you're going to build an F-35, you want some visibility in terms of the budgetary requirements before you make those purchases. But I would claim that the number of actual products or capabilities that require that are far fewer than how the DoD operates, right? You might say that's 1-2% of capabilities in the arsenal require 10-year visibility for a company to successfully make the investment into that product. Everything else you should be buying on 2-year cycles or competing every 2 years, 3 years, you know, much faster than it is today, right? We're in the second increment of a program of record. The first increment was 17 years. Right. And so to say technology is not going to change wildly in 17 years and that solution is going to be the solution you have, that's what leads us to be in this problem where, you know, we're racing to modernize as quickly as possible to get ready for, you know, potential conflict with a peer adversary.
Well, I was going to say the thing that drives you is these open reference architectures, right? I mean, there's been a lot of work over the last couple of years to try to open up that aperture and to allow things to be much more plug and play to accelerate that process. I mean, are you already seeing a positive impact from that? Is the ball moving more quickly or more easily in an open architecture universe with these common reference architectures to cross connect everything?
I think the DoD is moving in a good direction with the common reference architectures, right? That is, that's a result of not being happy with their current providers in terms of the capabilities that are being delivered. But actually, if I wanted to quickly just go back to one thing, and this is like one of the worst things about writing requirements is it absolutely stifles innovation, not just innovation in engineering and innovation of products, but actually innovation in the military solving the problem, right? If you say, hey, I need a aircraft or drone that flies for 24 hours, then one, that's going to dictate massive engineering requirements associated with it that a company is going to have to deliver on. The other thing it's going to do, it's going to limit the thinking of the warfighting personnel to say, well, I must have aircraft that can fly for 24 hours. Instead, maybe thinking, hey, you know what? If my ultimate problem is coverage over this area over a 24-hour period, then maybe I can accomplish this with 6 cheaper aircraft or something like that. And so that's something that it's the requirements acquisition system is the root cause of so many acquisition problems, so many challenges in our fighting force and our force architectures. And it just stifles innovative thinking for the warfighter, himself, herself.
In many respects, right from your mouth to God's ears, because I think you do need to be thinking comprehensively differently about how to address the problem, right? And what are the critical parts of the requirement that are important, right? From a commonality standpoint, as long as it's all predicated by in good reason, And then where's that broader innovation space that you can actually embrace to let folks think creatively about solving your problems, right? As opposed, and right, I mean, right now there's a big first mover disadvantage, isn't there, Brandon? Because right now, if Shield AI comes out with a better mousetrap, shows it to the Pentagon, they have a tendency of studying it, then putting a requirement out, and then having everybody compete for it. And so you're like, hey, wait a minute, guys, I put a lot of investment to bring this to you, and you're prolonging it, right? World War II was 3 years, 9 months, and we turned something that should be a fast acquisition to a longer one.
Yeah, no, 100%. Look, we've worked with large primes who say, we're not going to lift a pen until we see the requirements, because we've been burned so many times in the past, right? And so the other thing, a company can make the investment, right, and have what would typically be a first mover advantage in the commercial market. But then it's like, if they actually can't, you know, if they're unable to meet with the requirements writer, and the requirements writer like doesn't understand the value of that they're trying to deliver, or just or is influenced by another company that says, you know what, just write the requirements broad, write them, you know, like this, which, you know, happens all the time, then you're absolutely right. It's like that just stifles innovation. It stifles the adoption of new technology, new capabilities, right? We built a quadcopter that can autonomously explore inside buildings, named the most mission capable indoor quadcopter in the world by U.S. and Israeli forces during a competition, a fly off, used again to on a number of high level missions. And, you know, I'm so proud that it brought service members home safe back to their families. There is still not a requirement for an indoor autonomous quadcopter. It is, you cannot find it in any requirements document. And just to be clear, right, that's not a focus area of ours. I'm not bitter about it at all, right? Shield AI is, we've maneuvered to what the market's doing. We're adapting. We've got a great future in front of us, but it's I just think it's such like a case study of the problem in terms of actually getting the best solutions out to the warfighters, and why you're going to see great solutions just, you know, die on the vine if they're not fostered and cared for with an extreme level of attention, which should not be the standard to get warfighting capabilities into the hands of the men and women who need it.
Let me ask you a valley of death question that I alluded to, or mountain of death question, right? You either burn to death in the valley or freeze to death at the top of the mountain. Either way, it's an arduous journey. Where are you in that process, Brandon? And when people look sort of, right, where are you in that process? And then I've got kind of a 5-year out question as a follow up.
Yeah, no, I think we're scaling the mountain. We built a bridge to cross the valley of death. I am very optimistic about where we are. I'm not sure if I've actually heard the freeze at the mountaintop, but I'll just tell you, you know, I would love to be on the mountaintop. So, you know, and I'm used to being cold as a Navy SEAL, and I'd rather be cold than hiking up a mountain is what I would tell people. And so, you know, put me on that mountaintop. I'll bring a blanket. No, for us, it's a name of scaling the company at this stage in the game, which is, you know, a focus of ours.
Let me ask you before we get to the 5-year question, because we've got a couple of minutes left. But first, the making money question, right? I mean, the Silicon Valley prizes, valuation, and an ability to raise money. And you guys certainly have demonstrated that. You do have contracts, even though, you know, in the eyes of some, these contracts are not as vast as, you know, I'm sure you would like. You know, you mentioned Sibbers shops where folks are just sort of running through Sibbers, and, you know, there might not even be a growth strategy to get beyond that. Whereas you guys have raised sufficient money from real people to try to make that happen. Whereas Wall Street guys look at this from a profitability standpoint, right? Are you making money? They'll put up with some Amazons, right, along the path of not making money before you hit it big. From your standpoint, what does that look like? What does the profitability road look like? And at what point do investors need to adjust what their profit expectations are, given the magnitude of what companies like you are trying to achieve, right? You're breaking into a giant installed market, which has, you know, heritage operators have a large advantage here, right? What does that look like for you guys as you work through this path?
Yeah, and I actually think it's a misnomer that, you know, Silicon Valley venture capitalists don't value profits, right? And they are very much aligned with Wall Street in terms of both, you know, both industries, whether it's Wall Street or Silicon Valley backed venture capitalists, and they value, you know, future cash flows of a business. They value the growth of those future cash flows of a business. And so Shield AI, our aim is to generate massive cash flows in the future, right? And to your point, right, there's a lot of different ways to do it. You can focus on, you know, the mantra prior to 2021 for a lot of Silicon Valley venture-backed companies was growth at all costs. And I think that has fundamentally changed. You see companies being wildly rewarded for, you know, growth and a level of profitability. I think Palantir is a perfect example. I want to say they had their sixth profitable quarter in a row, right? And their stock market cap has gone from 20 billion to 55 billion in the past, you know, 24 months. And some might say, well, that's, you know, part of the market turning around. But I would also, you know, what that primarily is, if you look at every single one of their jumps, it's just they continue to demonstrate profitability. And so for us, that's, you know, how we think about the world too. I would say very few companies that are venture backed think about growth at all costs. You think about the right amount of growth to deliver also profitability. And so that's what we're focused on also, is being a high growth company that, you know, can flip the profitability switch on. I think it'll be surprising to a lot of people that switch will come on a lot sooner than people realize. And that's just, you know, lots of companies do that, right? They can grow quickly. Right. They can grow profitably. It's not, it's a hard thing to do, but the number of examples in the world are thousands of companies do that every single day.
How quickly, very briefly before I ask your last question?
How quickly? So I won't discuss Shield AI finances on the line, but I will just say it is, it's a focus of the business to run the business profitably.
Got it.
And grow at an incredible rate too. So
I would love to toast you on that success, Brandon. Let me ask you one last question, which is where you guys want to be in 5 years, right? I mean, the era of dumb money is over. So a little bit harder to raise capital even for good companies, even though you guys have a terrific, proven to be quite an engine on that. And I guess just briefly on my last point, there is often, in my view, sort of a disconnect in terms of profit expectations, whether they're on Wall Street or whether they're in Silicon Valley, right? I mean, sometimes I think the demand for return and a unsustainable return then drives companies and very good companies and very good people sometimes to make, I think, bad choices for the individual enterprise. That was sort of more, but there's probably a better way that I should have phrased it. When you're looking 5 years out, what does that 5 years look like? What are the kind of capabilities you guys want? You're being enabled by AI technology. You're being enabled by changes, quantum changes in manufacturing technology. Where do you guys want to be? And where do you guys think you'll be in 5 years?
Yeah. So first and foremost, everything at Shield starts with the mission. So I want to be accomplishing our mission at increasingly higher levels of scale. So missions to protect service members and civilians with intelligent systems. I want our AI pilot flying many different classes of aircraft, many different types of CCAs. I want us to be, you know, if you look at the aggregate number of those aircraft, probably in the tens of thousands of aircraft will have AI pilots on board. What's that look like from a financial perspective? You know, that's a $1 billion plus revenue business. That is a profitable business as well, highly profitable business. And so that is where we want to be as a company. You know, whether we're still private, whether we're still public is, you know, TBD and not something I concern myself a lot with. I fundamentally focus on, you know, driving the mission at scale, growing the business You know, that's what our focus is.
Our time is short. Let me just ask you one last question. The AI market is moving very, very rapidly. I mean, the unmanned market is improving, is also dramatically and very quickly changing. From an AI perspective, at first it was the smaller companies, because of the tools available, are able to move more quickly. On the other hand, there are those who say that, look, scale and mass matter, especially at a time when the giants are getting in this business as well, even though they're kind of boutique applications. What does the AI side of this business look like? And what are the tectonic changes that are happening around you? What does that mean for the competitiveness of a much smaller organization in this gigantic ecosystem?
Yeah, great question. A couple of things that I think about. So first and foremost, the market is transforming, right? They're going to cheaper, affordable hardware platforms with very intelligent software, right? It's moving towards this concept of intelligent, affordable mass. It doesn't mean you're getting rid of every single exquisite, expensive asset, but you're moving what the Air Force would call like a high-low force architecture, right? Some very expensive things, many, 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 many more less expensive things that are highly intelligent. Second thing I think about, Shield AI is definitely leading the way here. We've been working on a non-obvious problem in a non-obvious market for 9 years and have raised $1 billion in capital. And when you talk about AI as a, you know, AI and you know, how we think about it and what it means to the market. Look, AI is a tool. And I tell investors, like, a discerning investor is going to know how a company is using that tool to build products. Shield AI and Tesla are using AI to build many aspects of autonomy. OpenAI and Google, they're using AI to build sophisticated chatbots and some really amazing artists that can paint pictures and generate videos that, you know, are pretty incredible. And when I think, you know, what's common between what OpenAI, Google, Shield AI, Tesla are doing is that software design tools, infrastructure, and pipelines are the name of the game. This is why Google and Facebook were able to become such behemoths. It's because they had the best product. And the reason they had the best product was because they were able to quickly iterate on that product faster than anybody else in the world because of their investments in design tools, infrastructure, and pipelines, the internal tools, right? That's the secret sauce of Shield AI. But you need, and so that is a really hard thing for smaller companies to build out, right? It requires massive amounts of capital to do it, to build those design tools, that infrastructure, that pipeline. To be able to iterate on your products at a speed that, you know, the defense industry, the aerospace industry, quite frankly, has never seen before.
Brandon, thanks so very much for joining us. Fairwinds Following Seas on your enterprise and certainly in the pursuit of the Collier Trophy. We'll stand by for that and would love to have you join us again in the future soon. There's so many other questions that we'd love to tackle, and unfortunately, we're out of time for that today. Thanks so very much.
Thank you, sir.
And thanks to all of you for joining us. We appreciate it very much. Tune in again tomorrow for the Air Power Podcast, where we're going to be talking to the Chief Executive Officer of AeroVironment. Thanks very much. And until then, have a great day.